Coming up today, TfL has stripped Uber of its license to operate in London, we discuss. Plus, is Russia to blame for ship hacking in the Black Sea? And we dissect Google's latest big money acquisition. All that and more coming up. You're listening to episode 336 of the Wired UK podcast. This episode is brought to you by Glenfiddich Experimental Series, a selection of single malts that rewrite the rulebook and challenge tradition. Search Glenfiddich Experimental Series to find out more. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Vicky Turk.
Hello.
We're not going to discuss Uber in too much detail, but we'll get onto it in a minute and then do our normal round of three stories and a quiz. But first, let's do some facts. Matt Burgess, what did you learn this week?
I have learned the most people that have ever squeezed into one vehicle. It was a car. It was the Toyota RAV4, which is like a Jeep. How many people squeezed in?
I'm going to go for 126. No, wait, that's mad. No, 62.
It's not a bus.
Yeah.
Vicky? Basically, you have to go higher or lower. And 50-50 chance.
I think lower. I'm going to say 50.
41. So you're, yeah, it's a lot of people
both
to get into a cast.
It is. Yeah. Were they like special, small, bendy people?
I don't know that much detail.
Well, never mind. Next week. Vicky, what did you learn?
So I learned that kind of knew already, there are no essential male or female characteristics. But this includes things like risk-taking and competitiveness, which are often kind of attributed to men due to testosterone. This, I learned, is actually a myth. So this is from Cordelia Fine's book, which just won the Royal Society's Science Book Prize. It's called Testosterone Rex. And it's basically debunking a load of research that suggests that testosterone makes men different from women in certain ways, makes them behave differently. And it was very popular around the financial crisis, if you remember. There was lots of talk about how, you know, men take more risks and they've caused this big crisis because of testosterone made them do it. And she argues very convincingly, using a lot of evidence, that actually a lot of these studies were wrong. They were biased to begin with. And if you look at the data and what we know now, that this actually isn't the case. So she says, and I quite like this, while it's probably fair to say that it was mostly men who brought around the financial crisis, the fashionable contention that testosterone did it is an excellent example of what happens when flawed thinking is applied to public debate.
Which could also go for the financial crisis as a whole, I suppose, as to how to run a capitalist democracy.
Deep, James.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's interesting, the psychology of it, because if you tell someone that you're a man and your testosterone makes you more prone to taking risks, does that make you more prone to taking risks if you feel like you should because you will because you're a testosterone?
Seeming like societal stereotypes.
Reinforcement behaviour. Deep. I learned that a Lego brick can take up to 950 pounds of force without breaking.
That's not quite so deep, but pretty cool.
Yeah. So one test, a couple of YouTubers put Lego bricks to the test and they got a repetitive motion machine to put together and break apart a typical 2x4 brick or 2x4 bricks over and over and over again. 37,112 times before any sign of damage or snapping appeared.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was this
super
one of these
strong
hydraulic videos that's on YouTube?
I guess it's just a repetitive machine like go tick, tick, tick.
Because I really enjoy the hydraulic press ones when they just have a giant industrial press like crushing all sorts of objects like a bowling ball or like a sponge or something really weird. They're quite therapeutic.
Now we know what Matt Burgess does all day.
Yeah, that's what I'll go home in the evening and sit there and watch a hydraulic press destroy my favourite items.
It's what YouTube was made for. We should also mention very briefly that the Wired podcast is nominated for a Lovie Award. This is super prestigious, so we're very, very honoured and excited to be shortlisted. It's open to a public vote as well, so you, dear listeners, can help us win. Head to vote.loveyawards.eu/public voting and select the podcast category, then entertainment, then Wired UK. Vote now, tell all your friends. We're currently second in the public vote, so every vote helps, and we hope to have some good news to share with you in a few weeks' time. I think voting closes on October 5th. We've got a lot to fit in this week. I said we're not going to do it as a full story, but just as we came on to start recording the podcast, some big news broke in the world of technology. Uber has had its license revoked to operate in London. Matt, you wrote the story. It's all kind of still developing, but what's the latest?
So TfL, Transport for London, the regulator around transport and the regular feature on the Wire podcast in recent weeks, since we've been having a lot of transport news, has said that Uber, well, the branch of Uber that is in London, which is Uber London Limited, is the official company name, is not fit and proper to hold a private hire operator license in the capital. And it's given four main reasons for it coming to this decision. It says that its approach to reporting serious crime offences isn't correct. Its approach to how medical certificates for drivers are obtained isn't correct. The legal background checks of the drivers and the way that it does them isn't correct. And its approach to explaining the use of a grey ball service, which is sort of a, like blacklisting, but a bit more nuanced, which was sort of revealed to be happening in the US. It didn't explain how or what it was doing with that in London,
or if it was using it at all. So it's caused an awful lot of controversy. Uber itself has set up a petition online, which within a couple of minutes had gained 17,000 signatures for people that were desperate to get Uber back. We should say that Uber isn't gone. It has 21 days to appeal the decision, and you can still use Uber in London during that time.
And I think you can still use it throughout the process of the appeals, I believe, as well. So,
which is likely to take a very, very long
time. I mean, you know how these legal things drag on.
Goodness me, this is complicated.
But yeah.
It's something that's been coming to a head for a long time. And what's interesting about it is that Uber's license was up for renewal anyway, so TfL was always going to look at this and make a decision. And it's made the decision not based on how Uber defines its drivers, defines itself as a business, how it operates. Broadly, that was all fine. It all comes down to legal things, to very specific regulations that are there to protect drivers, to protect the public, and to protect city infrastructure. And that's where TfL has come down against Uber, which isn't quite how Uber's putting it to the public.
No, they're sort of saying that it seems to be they're banning this app because of a small group of people pressuring TfL. And by that, they effectively mean by black cab drivers who feel that they have been undervalued or sort
marginalized.
Of marginalized, yeah, because of Uber is cheaper and it treats its the people that drive for it in different ways to sort of the traditional model. But yeah, this is really about the law and the processes of Uber. It's not necessarily about the gig economy. It's not about how Uber treats its workers, whether they have the, I say workers, that is something that Uber would sort of disagree
contractors.
With contractors in Uber's view,
drivers,
yes. And basically it's not about that. It's about the sort of processes and the way it works internally and how it sort of deals with TfL and does some of the background processes that we don't see. So it's not about TfL isn't trying to ban you from not being able to get a cheap drunken Uber home.
Yeah, so what you'll see over the next few days is an awful lot of canned statements coming out of technology bodies or people who are on the side of Uber saying that this is a classic case of regulators being anti-innovation, anti-digital, anti-change. That isn't what this is. This is TfL applying the rules that apply to everyone else and need to apply to Uber and saying, sort it out, fix it up, then you can keep on, we'll probably then grant you a license to operate. So think about it before you sign a petition, before you mouth off on social media. Think about it. Think about what's actually happening here, because it might not be as it appears. And there's an awful lot of PR going on behind this on Uber's part. It's sent out an email to customers saying, you know, it's a very emotive issue. People like Uber. It's cheap. It's convenient. But it needs to abide by the same laws as every other private hire company in London. So we'll see what happens.
You can probably tell that we've been having a vibrant discussion about this in the
yes.
office today.
Yeah, and the reason Roland isn't allowed on the podcast is he has two stronger opinions, which you'll be able to read in an op-ed that we'll be putting live either later today, that's Friday, or over the weekend. So let's move on. Let's not get too distracted by Uber. We could keep on going for ages and people will probably get bored. Our first proper story this week is about ship hacking. Difficult to say, it turns out. Matt, what's been happening?
So, this is a story that I reported this week and it's been going on for a little while. And it sort of goes back to June, really, and maybe before this, but sort of the first instances of this came out around then. So I've been speaking to a captain of a 37,000 ton oil tanker who works around the Black Sea and a few areas sort of in that area near Russia. And he was taking his ship through one of the straits around there and going towards a port in Russia. I think it was in the region which is the Novorossiysk. I could probably pronounce that wrong. Let's go with that. But yeah, he was approaching there when he was he was sailing in, was going to go into the port, was just sort of waiting to be allowed in for traffic and things like this, and looked at all the systems on the bridge where he was sort of conducting the ship, and it was all fine. And then a few minutes later, there was some massive alarm started going off, and it said that the GPS systems had been taken down, had gone wrong.
And all of a sudden, the ship didn't really know where it was.
Yeah, so there are a number of different systems how ships navigate and sort of find their ways through the seas and sort of avoid things around them. And underpinning them all is GPS technology, which is the Global Satellite Positioning.
Global positioning system.
Oh, no, that's the rule. Yeah, there we go. Different acronym. And yeah, this underpins sort of all the technologies that are going on. And it's the same stuff that we have in mobile phones, that we have in sat-navs, that operate in satellites and things as well.
So it's a system that's based on a number of satellites orbiting the Earth. Some are they all run by the US military, or a selection of them are? And it's an international collaboration to make sure that bits of technology can always know where they are by using triangulation between points. So for a 37,000-ton tanker, that's pretty important.
Yeah, it is. And effectively, this ship's systems had were not working. And it turns out, after some research and a lot of other things around this, that they seem to have been affected by something that's called spoofing, which we'll come on to in a second. But the systems were actually showing the ship inland. They were showing it as appearing at an airport in Russia. And over the course of June and a few months around there, actually lots of other ships in this area, around 24, have been sort of seeing this problem come up as well. And on some of the systems that they have, it showed multiple ships in the same place. And like, obviously a 37,000 ton ship is huge. Like, we're talking,
and it's given a fair amount of breathing room.
We're talking hundreds of meters long, and you don't have them in the same place. You're not going to get two inside, like, probably half a mile, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So according to the system, these ships were basically just teleporting from the ocean where they actually were to this random spot near the airport on land.
Yes, they were. So they would have, if you were looking at the system, you wouldn't see them there. They effectively vanished from that part of the system and appeared inland, which again is
kind of impossible.
Somebody would notice if you had a giant ship at an airport.
And it's fascinating when you Matt got some of the pictures from the bridge of this ship, showing that it was in one place, then in another place, and that all made sense. And then all of a sudden, it jumped 25 nautical miles up to this airport on the Russian coast. So it's rather strange. So you said that this is to do with GPS spoofing. What does that mean?
So there are two ways that researchers think that the GPS system can be compromised. One of them is jamming, which is effectively sort of overloading a system and making it not work. So you won't have any signal at all. It's sort of akin to being in a tunnel where you've got no GPS connection, but done on purpose by somebody who is trying to block the signal. But in this case, it's believed that it was spoofing, which is a case of effectively mimicking another satellite. So when your GPS connects and can show you your location, it's connected to at least four satellites that are orbiting the world. Most of the time, it's probably more than four. But if you can mimic them, sort of using some technology, which can, some researchers have done this in sort of a testing situation. They've had it in like the size of a briefcase. They can send out a signal saying this is mimicking the satellite, so it's making the system think it's somewhere else.
Right, and the finger's been pointed to Russia because of the geography. This was happening right next to Russia, but there's also been another instance of Russia doing this around the Kremlin, which caused a bit of problems for local taxi companies who were trying to pick up people and all of a sudden teleported 25 miles away.
Yeah, that was Yandex, which is Russia's Uber, and probably is legal in the country.
And this
just
is
to link back to the.
This is a technological capability that a number of nation states hold. I think the US has done experiments with it, the British, the Russians, the Chinese. So it's not something that's unique to Russia, but it's something that's never been seen on this scale before.
Yeah, so the researcher that I spoke to that have been looking around this, they say that actually to do GPS spoofing, it's a pretty sophisticated attack. You need to sort of be able to manipulate atomic clocks and be able to sort of really understand how the systems work. And if you compare it to GPS jamming, you can buy devices on Amazon, on other places as well, that can actually just jam GPS in a phone or a sat nav or something. Really easily. So this is a sophisticated process. It obviously happened off the coast of Russia. Russia seems like it's got some connection doing this in its own country. Nobody's specifically said this was Russia, but it's like the evidence very, very strongly points towards them being able to do this.
So what does a captain do when he's captaining a 37,000 ton tanker, was it?
Yes.
And all of a sudden it moves on his positioning systems. Is that a really bad thing, or is it it's slightly more scary than it sounds?
A bit of both, really. I would say, like, in this situation, the captain that I spoke to was like, we didn't panic. We were shocked by this. We were a bit scared by it in some respects, but we looked at our other systems. We turned our GPS off and on again, and looked at like a backup one, and they both said this was both the case. And they're like, yes, there's the GPS systems actually can have errors on quite often, but they're normally like 100 meters or so, not 25 nautical miles. So he said that we just reverted to the old way of doing things. He looked at the radar, which you can't really get wrong because it's obviously sending out a wave, that a sound wave.
Yeah, it's like a ping from your ship.
Yeah. That is all localized. That can't really be tampered with. And other systems. There's one called Dead Reckoning, where you navigate based on your last known position and how far you've traveled, and it's all quite sophisticated in some ways, and I don't know the ways of the sea, but I think that
that's your next assignment.
He was obviously not completely shocked by this, and he's been back to that area 4 or 5 times, he said, and now when he goes back there, he actually turns off his GPS system, so all the alarms and everything don't go off.
So it's just become a way of life,
but
a slightly disturbing one.
But he did also warn that some ships these days, and maybe not oil tankers, maybe different ones, can rely on an autopilot sort of system which operates through GPS. If you were doing that, then there is the potential for disruption, for chaos, for people to send ships on different courses, things like this.
But for the moment, it all appears to be an awful lot like whoever's doing this, it's a bit of a smoke and mirrors game. So some of the conspiracy theories that you could draw out is maybe Vladimir Putin is in the area and they don't want people to accurately be able to plot positions using GPS for security reasons. It could be that a nation state is carrying out military exercises that it doesn't want people to be able to accurately track. There's something going on here. And
I was
going
to say, why would you want to do it?
Yeah, at the moment, there doesn't seem to be malicious intent. It's more to cause confusion.
Yeah, I would say that is the case. And the people that I've spoken to said it seems like somebody is testing a system because it is obviously so sophisticated. Like some of the researchers that have tried this in sort of a controlled setting, they spoof the GPS while on the ship. If you're obviously a good distance away, from maybe 20 miles from the coast away, you've got to have a stronger signal. You may have to be testing this. But also, and this is something they didn't really touch on in the story, there's been a couple of incidents where US military ships have collided with tankers, and not necessarily just tankers, but other boats in different oceans as well. And there's been a few deaths through these early this year. And there's some people that would say that potentially the systems on some of these ships could have been corrupted in that way. But again, there's not really strong enough evidence. Military ships have more highly sophisticated encrypted systems. Maybe the ones that crashed into them didn't, but I think it all comes into this sort of there's something going on.
Yeah, and we'll keep at it. I encourage everyone to go and read Matt's story on wired.co.uk. It's a really, really interesting bit of journalism, and we'll be sticking with the story and seeing what happens over the coming months, and probably years. But it's scary stuff, but there's some interesting technology behind it. Our second story this week, also interesting technology, as so often, tube barriers. We're going a bit transport nuts on the podcast of late.
Yeah, this is rather a more domestic transport story. I had the joy this week of going to a demo of the train ticket gate system of the future.
The thrilling life of a wire journalist.
It was actually pretty interesting. So I went to the Innovation Centre of Cubic Transportation Systems, which is the company that actually brought the Oyster card to London, the contactless payment card that you can use on the tube and some trains. And they built a prototype there of a new ticket validation system and ticket gate that isn't actually a gate, because the whole point is they've got rid of the gate.
A gateless gate.
A gateless gate, that is what they call it. A gateless gate line.
So the pain point that they're trying to solve here is, and this will be similar in an awful lot of cities around the world, in New York or in Paris, where you have underground barriers, is that you get a bottleneck. People get stuck all trying to leave.
Exactly. So, I mean, underground or overground, if you have...
Wombling free.
Nice.
If you're at the station and you have that line of gates with those paddles that open when you show your ticket, and then close when you've gone through. They let one person through at a time. Yeah, you end up with this kind of crush of people, everyone kind of digging in their pockets to get their ticket out. And it's a real bottleneck for getting people from the station onto the platform. So getting rid of that single gate line, they suggest, would help ease that problem, so you don't have this big crush.
So you'd have almost a gating area where people would be validated
exactly.
as they left the train.
And as you step through onto the train. So there's kind of two parts to the system, right? So first is the ticket validator. So we know these already. In London, you get the yellow circle that you can put your Oyster card on, you can put your contactless card on, you can put your ticket through the little barrier, your paper ticket.
You can put your watch on it, your phone on it.
So many options. So that's the first part of it. And Qubic has developed this next generation version of one of these validators, which looks very similar. It's still got the contactless card reader. They've also put Bluetooth LTE in, which is something that you could download in an app on your phone. And then the interesting thing about that is you don't actually have to take your phone out of your pocket and hold it directly over the reader, because it works at a bit of a distance. So you could theoretically just walk past. And also a couple of biometric options, which are slightly more controversial. So these are a palm vein scanner. So a little thing that you put your hand on, and it reads the unique pattern of your veins in the hand and registers that as you.
Cool.
And also face recognition. So again, you'd look at the face recognition sensors, the 3D sensors and cameras, and it would say, yes, oh, that's Vicky. We'll bill her payment card for a journey.
I'm going to sound my alarmist privacy claxon here, but I know you have an answer to this. This will raise privacy concerns.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't.
Well, I mean, so it's definitely depends on the individual. I think many people are a bit creeped out by the idea of using face recognition in this way.
Yeah.
And obviously, any company that is going to collect that kind of biometric data will have to have very good privacy and security settings on that. They will have to be able to keep that data safe and secure and protect the privacy of their customers.
But what they're not doing is linking that biometric data to people directly.
No, they are.
Oh, they are?
In this instance, yeah. So what you would do is you would go to a station, you would, or an office or something, you would register your palm print or your face to your ID, and you'd connect it, like you currently do your Oyster card, to your bank details.
Yeah.
And so then essentially your face or your palm print becomes, your palm vein pattern, becomes your Oyster card.
Well, this is an absolute dream for law enforcement.
So, yeah, I mean, there's certainly questions as to whether you would want your biometric data in these databases. But, you know, we've seen iPhone 10 now using face recognition to unlock the phone. I think these systems are slowly becoming more common. So maybe public perceptions will change a bit on that.
Maybe. And it's likely that when these systems are deployed on London's transport network, that they'll be used at stations where there aren't currently barriers.
So this is the other part. And I should say that Qubic doesn't expect the face recognition thing to be in play for the next at least few years, because it's simply not accurate enough. I mean, we all saw the iPhone 10 demo where it didn't work.
When Apple,
the big Apple show, their one opportunity to show it off, and it didn't work. Yeah, it's just not accurate enough. So it would just cause queues at the ticket barrier like we have now, right? It wouldn't solve the problem. So moving on from the validator, you've validated your ticket in whatever way, with your Oyster card, with your face, with your palm vein pattern.
But probably with your Oyster card.
for now, with your contactless card. And then usually you would go through the gate.
Yeah. Or not.
They are suggesting here that instead of having a gate, you'd just have a corridor. You'd walk, saunter through at leisure. And they use an object tracking system that essentially sees you validating and then tracks you as you go through the system.
Gotcha.
or sees you not validating and then tracks you as you walk through the corridor. And the one that I tried, when you validate and then you walk through, there's some lights turn green. If you don't validate and try to walk through, the lights turn red. And they're playing with other feedback as well. So maybe you could have a sound that sounds
when
someone tries to jump the
pit that opens up in front of you and you just fall down
exactly.
into the center of the earth.
Excellent. A voice of God.
you
there. Pay your fare.
It's just a bit complicated, isn't it?
Well,
do we need this? Do we really
There still are a number of stations on London's transport network that don't have physical barriers for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. Either there aren't staff at those stations, so you have to have a member of staff present in order to have barriers closed. So you quite often go to a station and the barriers will just be open. It's because there's not a member of staff.
Otherwise,
there.
People get stuck. So you need someone who can extricate you or your luggage.
And it also helps that there's a problem with London's transport network, and this would be the same in Paris and New York and Berlin and lots of places where the capacity causes bottlenecks. So if you can move people through areas more mm-hmm. quickly, then you don't have those same bottlenecks. So it's got a number of different applications. It's certainly an interesting development.
Yeah. So, I mean, Cubic hopes to initially deploy this at a station that currently doesn't have gates. So if you think in London, there's a lot of kind of underground stations that don't have gates, and you have to remember to tap the Oyster reader, otherwise you'll charge the maximum journey.
Pretty much the whole of the Docklands Light Railway
doesn't
have barriers.
Exactly. So rather than using it as a policing method, it could actually be kind of a reminder to passengers, like, hey, you're going to be charged the maximum fare if you don't tap in, and you haven't tapped in, so why don't you go and do that?
Yep.
So that could be useful.
I'm not sold. I don't know why, but I'm just not...
Matt Burgess, fare skipper.
Yeah. That's what they say, yeah.
So it was an interesting little look at a potential future technology that could be at rail stations at some point in the future.
I forced you to come onto the podcast to talk about it before you've even written the story. But we will be publishing the story hopefully around the same time as the podcast. So do go and have a read. I presume there's some useful visual aids to help people understand it.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. It's really not that complicated. I actually think it's quite an interesting idea. And I like the idea that, when you have gates, you're kind of assuming that everyone hasn't paid and then you only let them through when they prove that they have.
It's true.
Whereas having this system, you're kind of assuming that most people have paid the fare and then there's just a couple of people you have to catch out.
Mm, and you can carry out wide-scale surveillance of urban populations as well, which is always helpful.
I should add the object tracking bit that checks if you've paid, and when you walk through the kind of gate corridor thing, doesn't actually identify you as a person. It just tracks person validating and then continuing through there.
Oh, well, there you go then. It's fine. Until the face and palm stuff comes along, we're all still free to live our lives without being... we are cons. Anyway, story three. Google this week has spent an awful lot of money on HTC's tech division. It hasn't bought the whole of HTC. It's bought about 2,000 research and development people for $1.1 billion, which is about £815 million, or soon to be about £1 billion if Brexit keeps on happening. So HTC is the Taiwanese smartphone maker. It's been pretty close to Google for a while. HTC built the first Android phone, the Dream, way, way back in, I can't remember when, probably 2007, 2008, 2009, 2008.
A while ago,
about a decade ago. And it designed the first Google-branded phone, which was the Nexus One. So Google has said that creating beautiful products that people rely on every single day is a journey, and we are investing for the long run. So their $1.1 billion investment for them is part of their long-term strategy to be more competitive with the likes of Apple and Samsung, and that's all about owning the whole chain.
Yeah, exactly. And this sort of comes around the same time that October the 4th, which I think is next week, or
yep.
Yeah, 2 weeks away maybe,
pretty soon.
Google's holding its next sort of big press event where it's going to unveil some more hardware that it's been working on, and part of this is going to be its Pixel 2, which
yes.
is its follow-up to the first Google phone. I did air quotes around that. I don't know why, because nobody who is listening to this would have seen them.
No, but you did. He did do air quotes.
But I did do them. So
it's almost inevitable that HTC will make the Pixel 2. We're pretty sure of that. Well, we are, because the whole thing's leaked already. Tech companies are terrible at keeping secrets at the moment. So as well as the transfer of experienced staff, Google is also getting non-exclusive licenses for HTC intellectual property to support the Pixel smartphone family, hence why we're pretty sure that the Pixel 2 will be made by HTC. It's an interesting development in that Google's already tried to do this and failed quite badly. So in 2014, it bought Motorola Mobility for $12.5 billion. A couple of years later, it sold it to Lenovo for $2.91 billion, which, I mean, I'm no business person, but that's, you know, that's a heavy loss to take. What Google did take out of that was an awful lot of patents. So maybe this was in a slightly backwards
way. So maybe
way.
You're actually not a good business person.
Maybe the patents were worth that. I think it got about 2,000 technology patents out of it, and some expertise and some staff that it retained. So maybe in a slightly backwards way, this was part of its strategy. It needed the patents, and now it needs the staff. And HTC is a very close collaborator with Google for a number of years, can provide those staff. So this is great news for Google, but it might be fairly terminal news for HTC. It's lost half of its R&D workforce and an awful lot of expertise and technology with it.
Yeah, I'd imagine, and this is pure speculation on my part, that going forward, HTC is not going to focus as much on its own phones, maybe?
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's said that its short-term strategy, well, it said that it will keep on making HTC phones, so the U11 at the high end, and it makes a number of low-end phones as well. But it's kind of difficult to see when it's lost so much of its talent.
Yeah, I guess a big focus for them will continue to be, and, well, they will hope, will be the HTC Vive.
Yeah, so it's got the VR thing going stuff, for it. And so technologically, it's a long way ahead of Oculus Rift. And one analyst, Annette Zimmerman, who works for Gartner, said that she didn't see a turnaround for HTC's phone business based on this, and it will further diminish the business that they have and its competitiveness amongst other Asian vendors, the likes of LG, Samsung, and globally, Apple. For normal people, because that's what's often lost in these big business stories. So what does it mean for you? Well, there's a number of options to select from here, but let's go with the biggest one. It probably means that Google is going to get more like Apple. It will want more control over the process. So Google will now own the staff who develop the processes for its phone, both in terms of software and in terms of hardware. And while Android has always been kind of an open smorgasbord compared to iOS, now it might be more closed. And Google needs to do that in order to compete, in order to develop augmented reality technology, in order to develop new standards for mobile.
Yeah, I guess it depends what these staff are going to be used for. I'd imagine they're probably going to be used more on the hardware side of things than actually the Android application. And I think that Google's made a big play in the last couple of years on its own hardware, so that's probably why it wants these people. In my view, I don't think they'll do too much to Android. I think they'll try to keep it open, but I think that some of the most recent versions of Android we've seen have been best on the Google phones. So it's a case of maybe bringing it all together.
But it's an optimization thing as well, particularly as smartphone operating systems rely more and more on artificial intelligence, either operating on the device or in the cloud, or both, is what will actually happen. Google really needs this incredibly close link between the hardware it manufactures and the software. And as it starts to make augmented reality and virtual reality headsets and other bits of hardware for around the home, and all of that stuff is talking to each other, owning the whole chain of manufacturing, software, research and development, and having that in-house is hugely, hugely valuable and makes Google more like Apple and Samsung, which is probably its end game. To compete as a hardware manufacturer.
I'm not going to disagree with that. You put that very well. You've convinced
Thanks.
Me.
Thanks. I offer consultancy at competitive rates.
I need to buy a new phone at the weekend.
Oh, lordy. Let's not do
this. I mean,
this.
You just offered.
Yeah. I would say go low end. So there used to be a time when buying a cheap smartphone meant you got a cheap smartphone. But now, for a couple of hundred quid, you can get a really, really good one. So look at the Moto brand. That's a good one. You can't really go wrong with that. And it will, or even a Nokia. It will come with a very unfussy version of Android, as close as possible to raw Android as possible. But if you want something with a super flashy camera, then you're going to need to spend more. If you want to play lots of mobile games, then you're going to need to spend more. But most people just want to browse the web, check their emails, and that's it, right?
Listen to this podcast.
wired.co.uk/podcast. Yes, exactly. So yeah, just don't spend too much money.
Did you just tell people who are already listening
yes,
to the podcast
that's how, you
how
can
they
listen.
Can listen to the podcast?
Yes, I did. It's almost time to go home. But not before. A quiz. He says frantically, leafing through his notes. Okay, right. So last week, I somewhat dropped the ball. We talked about Lego on the podcast last week, and I did a very, very boring quiz about SIM cards, which, which just about drove Jeremy to distraction. So how much do you know about Lego?
Yes, the yes. quiz I've been waiting for.
Exactly.
I should have been on the SIM card one.
That's I know.
That's my specialty.
Yeah, which is the smaller of the two SIM card formats, Matt? Is it mini or micro?
Micro.
Yes.
Oh, that was a good guess.
Very good. Okay, this week's quiz. Lego. What does Lego mean? What is the name Lego
mean? Oh, it means something like let's play or something, doesn't it?
That's your guess, okay.
I'm going to say creativity.
I think Vicky Turk is closer. So it's created for the first two letters of the Danish words leg and gort, which means play well.
Yeah, you get that.
Lego. What's the plural of Lego?
Lego.
Lego.
Yes, yes.
Or Lego bricks.
Yeah, you could have that. Not erroneously, as a number of Americans would say, it's not Legos. You don't play with your Legos, you play with your Lego. Very good, you both get a point. Other than plastic bricks, which is a bit obvious, what is Lego the world's largest producer of?
Ooh.
This is a really good question.
Is this something... Ooh, theme parks? Or
no,
maybe
it's like... It's a specific thing.
Oh, a specific thing.
Wheels.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that right?
It is, yeah. So, you're not allowed to say the same thing. Yeah, it's rubber wheels. They produce them more than Bridgestone, Goodyear... What is it? Fire something or other? Yeah, they produce more rubber wheels than any other car tyre manufacturer. And they're tiny. In 2012... The most recent year I could find figures for, Lego produced 45.7 billion bricks. How many is that per hour?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. 45.7 billion bricks in a year.
Ooh. I mean, if we were good at maths, we could figure that, you know, their factory probably runs about 8 hours a day, la da da. But I'm not good at maths.
No, I'm not even going to attempt the numbers either. So I'm
you have to say a number.
Well, yeah. I'm
so wait, how many
guess.
Billion?
45.7 billion bricks a year. How
so
many per hour?
50 billion. 52 weeks in a year. So that's like a billion a week. So that's like...
How many hours in a week?
I don't know.
But 24 times 7. That's that 175-ish.
A billion divided by 175.
This is good. You're showing you're working as well. You get a mark for that.
Wait. How much is that?
Come on.
I don't know. I'm gonna guess. So a billion a week. I'm going to say 60 million an hour.
60 million an hour. Vicky Tug.
Wait.
No.
A million an hour.
A million. You're closer. It's 5.2 million. Yeah. Next week you can bring on calculators.
You divide it by 10 instead of 100, Matt. Just
FYI. Oh, I didn't.
FYI.
I sort of went for an educated guess. I gave up on the maths.
Okay, this one, it's two all, so for the win. Ooh. Until 1999. What? Oh, no, actually, I guess Vicky was closer. But no, no one gets a point for that one. You were both far too far away. Until 1999, what kind of minifigure, accessory, or playset had Lego famously never produced?
Until 1999?
I think I've got a good guess on this.
Can you repeat the question?
I can.
Because this is like a tiebreaker,
yeah.
So...
I'm ready.
For the championship, until 1999, what kind of minifigure, accessory, or playset had Lego famously never produced?
Star Wars.
What?
That could be completely wrong.
But why would it be famous that they'd never produced it?
Ooh, why? Mm. Well, that's his guess. Would you like a guess?
Okay, well, could I just say like a branded franchise?
No. Well, I think it had its own branded franchise. It had this awful thing called Dolls or something.
That means I'm wrong.
Yeah, well, you're close. And I'll give you half a point to let you win by half a point. It's military. And one of the answers is Star Wars. So in 1999, Lego changed its policy and started licensing kits that featured weapons. Before that, it had no weapons. But from 1999 onwards, it licensed weapons, but only in fantasy settings. So Star Wars and Harry Potter.
That's really interesting.
There we go.
So, but I remember having a police station set, but I guess maybe the police didn't have weapons.
Yeah, I had a police station set as a kid as well.
I don't recall them having weapons.
No, maybe they didn't. Yeah, well, they can't have. Either that
now we know.
Either that or the fact is wrong. No, it isn't. Facts are sacred. No fake news on this podcast. We'll see you... Oh, no, vote. Vote for us in the Lovery Awards. Please do. We'll remind you again next week. Tell all your friends, and we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.